After the invasion of Iraq and the discovery that there were indeed no weapons of mass destruction there, the media were strongly criticized for their coverage of the lead-up to the invasion. Here to discuss what happened and whether the press has changed much in the years since is WNYC's own Brooke Gladstone. She's the co-host of On the Media. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. Welcome
back to our show. It's always a pleasure to be here, Lenny.
Should we expect the press to always question the government's version of the facts?
Of course. Absolutely. I mean, the problem is the conditions under which that questioning takes place. Usually the press is able to question the government if Congress is questioning the government. But if Congress keeps quiet, the media have no protective cover, and they end up being accused of partisanship when they raise those questions.
And there were a couple of people in the media who questioned it. People at Knight Ritter. Was it also McClatchy?
Yes.
But they were largely ignored because they were outside of the Washington Beltway?
Walter Pincus and the Washington Post also did. Those were duly reported. They were put in their papers, in the case of Walter Pincus, sometimes buried in the back. But it wasn't so much that the others were unquestioning, so much as that the placement of the stories and actually.
So these were editorial decisions.
These are editorial decisions. They are. And some of the material was there. Some of the people went more aggressively towards dissenters within the intelligence community that said weapons of mass destruction were unlikely, and the aluminum tubes that were discovered really weren't made to do what they were being reported. All of that stuff was there. But again, the fear of being called partisanship at a time when the nation was still in trauma. And I met a bunch of Chinese journalists once who said American journalists pull their punches because they're afraid of the government at that time. But they weren't ever afraid of the government. They were afraid of their own audiences and advertisers.
But they had become more timid after 9/11, hadn't they? Or was this just business as usual because we have seen similar things over the years?
9/11 was not business as usual in any way. And the timidity came because of one's own. Journalists, hard to believe, are people too. They felt anguish after 9/11. They felt also the anguish of their audiences and the sensitivity of their advertisers to criticizing the government directly. They wished they had Congress to do it for them. Congress wasn't doing it either.
Many of us will recall the early days of the war and the shock and awe campaign and the aggressive bombing campaign that dominated the early coverage on TV screens during the war. Is its very name a clue as to how it was a media campaign as well as a bombing campaign?
Well, shock and awe is very cinematic, right? Of course, there is a long tradition of naming campaigns. So this wasn't so much a new idea as it was.
But it's stronger than Desert Storm.
Desert Storm, yes, or Desert Shield, or Operation Iraqi Freedom, or any of those others. It was a very cinematic war. All of the cable channels actually had dramatic music to underscore their updates on the war.
A listener wonders if what you mentioned earlier was a matter of was a chicken and egg problem. Did Congress not question the administration because the media weren't questioning the administration, and vice versa?
It's a very good question. My sense of this very strongly is that Congress questions the government for reasons of their own. For political reasons. They don't follow the press generally. They want to make a point by questioning the leader, and there wasn't much political capital to be made from questioning President Bush in the wake of 9/11.
The way shock and awe was presented, did the press miss the human costs of the time? I don't recall hearing very much about the invasion from the perspective of the people who were being bombed.
Well, shock and awe, of course, was a very, very brief, couple of days. Then it was the invasion, and that was very quick. And it is certainly true that at least in the initial coverage and throughout most of the television coverage, one never saw where the bombs landed and only where they took off. And that was because of the singular innovation of the military in media manipulation, which was embedding reporters with the troops.
My guest is Brooke Gladstone, co-host of On the Media. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So you are troubled by the whole process of embedding?
I'm not troubled by it. I think that savvy reporters knew right away that this was going to be a risk. You, as one military historian told me, you can't help but fall in love with these young men and women who are charged to protect your life when you are with them covering the war. You see the war through the proverbial, it was used all the time, soda straw, and you had to be aware that your view from the troops can't be the only view. There would have to be other reporters scattered elsewhere, but it was a very, very dangerous field. Of course, all war zones are dangerous.
There was also the story of Private Jessica Lynch. Can you remind us what happened to her?
Yes, Private Jessica Lynch in March of 2003 was a supply unit specialist. Her Humvee blew up. She ended up in the custody of Iraqi authorities and then in an Iraqi hospital. And the initial story was that she had been raped, that she had suffered stab wounds. Her comrades came in, guns blazing, and rescued her from the hospital where she was under Iraqi guard. Later, this turned out not to be true. Jessica Lynch herself said she wasn't raped. She didn't have stab wounds, that she was being wounds, that she was being treated for injuries sustained in the Humvee accident, and that these were just doctors, just Iraqi doctors. But that was not how it was initially portrayed in hundreds of newspapers.
And wasn't there a dramatic footage of the rescue?
There was dramatic footage of the rescue. Some later charged that they were actually, that the soldiers involved in that rescue were actually shooting blanks. We can't confirm that, but that does sort of speak to the suspicion of the whole event after the fact.
And then later there was a scandal involving the way the death of Pat Tillman occurred.
Right.
And how that was told to the public. Now, Vietnam War was called a living room war, a television war, and I guess the Pentagon was upset by how that played out, how the public perception of that war played out, because we were seeing what was going on. So they were controlling what we were getting from Iraq?
Well, it had been years and years and years since Vietnam, decades really, that since Americans had been allowed, American reporters had been allowed in the field of war. So this was great. At least Americans were allowed to get there. But there were rules. There were very, very rarely dead American soldiers shown, even in newspapers, and they were never shown on television.
But why did the media need to pump up stories like Jessica Lynch and Pat Tillman? Was it just a matter of it making good television?
The media were given this dramatic story, and media love narrative. It's a terrific, you know, we have a narrative bias in the media. We like to tell stories. This was a story of heroes. Why wouldn't we want to tell it? I don't think the media necessarily thought that it was being hyped at the time. They just didn't question the intelligence sources that were feeding them the story, and therein lies the problem.
Would you say that the Pentagon was fairly media savvy in the stories that it chose to promote about the war?
I think the Pentagon was brilliant in the stories that it chose to promote until it gradually lost control of the process.
And that's because of leaks that they could not have predicted, like the Abu Ghraib photographs.
Right. But then again, interestingly enough, Abu Ghraib was first reported, or at least the abuse of detainees was reported some 2 years before the pictures emerged. And without the pictures, it wasn't sticky. The story just wasn't sticky, not with other media outlets and not with the public.
And it wasn't until Seymour Hersh actually wrote that story in The New Yorker, by the way, a magazine that had strongly supported the invasion. David Remnick and some of the other writers for The New Yorker had supported the invasion initially have apologized.
Some did, some did briefly support it in the run-up. They believed Colin Powell's presentation before the UN. It was a persuasive presentation. But I don't want to speak to the positions of the New Yorker writers. I think that even more important than the New Yorker story were the pictures on 60 Minutes, frankly.
Now, this was an example of digital technology actually changing the course of public perception.
In what way?
Well, we're not talking about film. We're talking about somebody taking digital pictures and then
right.
And
well,
then emailing them back to their family.
they could have taken Kodak shots and sent them back. There was I think that social media and online media had a great impact on how we understand the war. Not so much the Abu Ghraib part of it as things like blogs from Iraqis, you know, who lived there, and also soldier blogs. There were all sorts of strands of unofficial information and a reaction and kind of a gut-level, palpable sense of what the war was like that was coming from people who were not professional journalists.
And that's how we found out about the toppling of the statue of Saddam Hussein, which originally looked like it was a public reaction.
Oh, you mean the correction of the toppling, yeah. Not the toppling itself. Yeah, the toppling of the statue was just a perfect example of the pressure of the media to shape events, the military responding to those events, and then ultimately it being shown for what it is. All you needed was somebody taking a wider shot of the square to realize that there really weren't that many people there. It was actually Peter Moss in The New Yorker who talked about how both the Iraqis and the American military were egged on by the presence of the media there to make this event bigger than it could have been. And of course, it was the American military that ultimately toppled that enormous statue of Saddam Hussein. But did you know that the story was so initially popular that that footage was shown every 7.7 minutes on CNN and every 4.4 minutes on Fox Cable News? That is how emblematic and iconic the media thought that footage would be until it turned out to be utterly misleading.
So has it been a public reckoning for any of the journalists? Judy Miller wound up going to jail, but not because she had misled the public. But what about the other people who advocated so strongly for going to war? Are they still writing op-ed columns in our major journals?
I don't think that expressing an opinion that turns out to be bad in any way hinders your career as a pundit. And in terms of the reporters, you know, they have, you know, the New York Times apologized for being a little bit too credulous when it came to the information that it was getting from the government.
But it did it in a very, very self-protective way.
Well, you know, there's going to be good reporting and there's going to be bad reporting in every event that ever gets reported. War is particularly subject to all the biases that are baked into the media business. And this one, following the greatest attack on American soil, you would expect that the media would go the most awry after an incident like that. I'm certainly not apologizing for it. I've spent the last, you know, decade chronicling the messes that American media made, but you can understand why.
But the whole role of a pundit is to see the story behind the story, to give us the real scoop. And if the pundits just become cheerleaders for government policies, then why are they even allowed to continue being pundits? Shouldn't they just be something else?
I think I have to quibble with your definition, what appears to be your definition of the word pundit, just an opinionator.
Uh-huh.
When you talk about those who apply, who present context and a broader historical view and a broader view on the ground, you know, some of the very people who may have initially supported the war and turned against it explained exactly why. One of the best books on the war, it was written by George Packer, Assassin's Gate, who had supported the invasion in its very early days before he saw very clearly where it was heading. And it was, you know, those are just journalists who do a really wonderful job of digging in and questioning their own assumptions and talking to people. Most pundits are just sitting there in their pajamas staring out the window with a single rivulet of drool coming out the side of their mouth.
Well, so can we expect the media to make similar mistakes, for example, in the reporting of Iran? And Paul Krugman said yesterday, I guess it was, that there are parallels today with the way the press is reporting the so-called deficit crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So does the press ever learn from its mistakes, or is Paul Krugman just wrong there?
Again, I don't want to weigh in on what Paul Krugman says. He's absolutely welcome to his opinion, and I have no doubt that he is 100% right and 100% wrong, because the media is a very, very vast enterprise.
Thank you. It is plural.
And unless we're speaking about it as a single identity with cause. But in this case, you know, because there's so much of it, you can find great and terrible reporting on every single issue. And the responsibility really falls on the individual to make sure that they're consulting the wisest sources on a story, and that is possible.
And I assume this is the justification for creating a show like On the Media, which has its mission looking at the way the media handle these kinds of stories.
Well, you know what?
Wish you had been around in 2001 when we were going to war?
We were, actually. We started in January of 2001. And we were, in fact, I think on our first show we did Bush's inauguration. So we did sort of evolve throughout the entire process. The purpose of the show essentially is just to provide people with tools so they can evaluate why some of this stuff comes out the way it does. And, you know, just the way you know a movie reviewer's biases, you can understand the biases of the media.
Brooke Gladstone is the co-host of On the Media, which is broadcast every weekend all over the WNYC schedule, AM and FM, and around the country as well. Do you know how many stations?
About 350.
Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thanks for having me, Lenny.